Good evening. Welcome to Behind the News for April 20, 2006. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two segments up tonight. First, we'll speak with some folks who are involved in producing The New Yorker's Guide to Military Recruitment in the Five Boroughs, a very handsome booklet that explains to you how to avoid the temptations of the military recruiters in New York. Very attractive little item, as well as being a very informative item. And they'll all be joined by Jose Vasquez, who is the president of the New York chapter of Iraq Veterans Against the War. So this is, I guess, a before joining the military and after joining the military theme for the first segment of the show. And then at the bottom of the hour, interview I recorded yesterday with the prolific author and former Republican consultant Kevin Phillips, whose latest book is called American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. That will be a little after the half-hour mark. And before we get to that, just a couple of news headlines. The weekly tally of jobless claims, the number of people who have just lost their job and signed up for unemployment benefits for the first time, down 10,000 last week after being up 12,000 the week before. So the uptick we've seen since the beginning of January seems to be stabilizing. So as with many job market indicators, the jobless claims figures are good but not great, but it does point probably to an expanding job market in the coming months. And then it was earlier this week, the Labor Department reporting that consumer prices were up 0.4% in the month of March, that following a very small increase in February, but a large increase in January. The year-on-year inflation up 3.4%, the annual rate of the last 3 months, 4.3%. So the continuing rise in oil prices does seem to be pushing inflation a little higher. This could well alarm the Federal Reserve, which sets policy in part based on what's happening with consumer prices. And I know a lot of people say that the CPI is a useless and misleading measure of prices, but it's as good as we got, it does tell you at least when prices are rising more rapidly or rising more slowly, it does seem to be pointing towards increased price pressures, which may alarm the Federal Reserve. And then earlier today, the Bureau of Economic Analysis reporting that multinational corporations, let me start that from the beginning. Some people are saying that the reason employment has grown so slowly over the last few years is that multinationals are doing all their investing and hiring abroad. New figures released today by the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the statistical generating arm of the Commerce Department, or one of several, shed some light on this. Unfortunately, the most recent year they have numbers for is 2004, but they do show that multinational corporations have been shrinking employment in their domestic operations while hiring abroad. But the hiring abroad was very slow, just an average of 0.4% a year. During the 1990s boom, they expanded more rapidly abroad than they did at home, but they were expanding pretty strongly at home as well. Now, there's a similar picture with investment, that is, investment in machinery and buildings and such, real things, not investment in stocks and bonds and derivatives and such. They are also investing at home, less at home and more abroad, but this is in contrast with the 1990s, when their domestic investments grew more rapidly than foreign investments. And the pace of foreign investment in recent years has been only half of what we saw in the 1990s, so multinationals have been fairly austere all around. It is important to keep this in perspective. Multinational corporations are not that big a presence in the U.S. job market. They account for just 16% of U.S. employment. Small and medium-sized businesses are the major generators of jobs, major employers of people, and they're not just not doing as much hiring as they should be. So like outsourcing, multinationalization explains only a small portion of our economic stress. As with most things, most of our problems are homegrown. And I've been getting a good response for my appeal for emailed questions to ask for some economic basics. And if you want to email a question to me, I'll be happy to answer. D. Henwood, D-H-E-N-W-O-D, at panix.com. That email address is also linked off the WBAI website. Go to the schedule, look for Behind the News, and you should be able to follow it that way. One of the questions I got, a very good one and a timely one, is how does the Fed control interest rates? It's timely given the release of minutes earlier this week of the Fed's policy-setting open market committee meeting, which meets every 6 weeks to discuss the state of the economy and their policy reaction to it. Right after the meeting, they issue a short press release that recounts their diagnosis and policy prescription. A month or so later, longer minutes are released, and then after 5 years, full transcripts, which are released, but they don't get much attention. But if you read the transcripts, you learn that they're obsessed with the state of the class struggle, or to use less fiery language, the balance of forces between capital and labor. They don't want unemployment so high that it threatens economic and/or political stability, but they don't want it so low that workers can tell their bosses just to shove it. They also worry about whether the economy is overheating, as they say. That means shortages of commodities, bottlenecks in distribution and such that might lead to rising inflation. Earlier this week, minutes released from the previous meeting showed that they might be near the end of a long tightening cycle that's seen 15 consecutive increases in interest rates at their policy meetings since 2004. They had pushed rates down very low after the bursting of the stock market bubble in 2000 because they were afraid that a sinking stock market might take the real economy down with it. For the last couple of years, they've been pushing rates higher to more normal levels, whatever exactly that means. Wall Street has been wondering when they were going to stop. The minutes showed that looks like they're thinking that they're close to an end. But if you read the transcripts and study the Fed's history, you learn that they do get worried when the unemployment rate gets below 5%, when oil and other commodity prices are rising, and more than 80 or 82% of factory capacity is in use. All these things are signs that things are getting a little too tight, a little too hot, and all these things apply right now. When that happens, they usually push interest rates high enough to cause a recession or a serious slowdown, something that would throw these indicators of heat or overheating into reverse. So even though the minutes said they might be close at least to pausing on the tightening cycle after the May Federal Open Market Committee policy meeting, it would be unusual for them to back off and let the economy get tighter and hotter. So we'll see what the data looks like in the coming weeks, but they may actually be concerned, as I was saying earlier, the signs of at least some inflationary pressures growing. So they may turn more hawkish in the coming weeks. But how do they influence interest rates exactly? There are only two interest rates under the Fed's direct control. One is the so-called discount rate, at which banks can borrow directly from the Fed, but that's only done in emergencies, like when a bank is in serious trouble. The major policy instrument they use is the so-called federal funds rate. This is the rate at which banks lend each other money overnight. Simplifying somewhat, big banks are chronically short of funds because they're very aggressive at making loans and have plenty of customers, and small banks are generally flush with cash because they can't find enough people and companies to lend money to. So the small banks generally lend their spare cash to big banks. It's not all a matter of big and small, but usually there are some banks with spare cash and some lacking it. The flush banks lend money to their cash short comrades and charge them interest rates at the so-called federal funds rate. So when the Fed wants to ease, it pumps money into the banking system by buying up U.S. Treasury securities from the banks that hold them. When it wants to tighten, it drains money by selling some of its own hoard of Treasury bonds, soaking up some spare cash. A level of spare cash, whether it's plentiful or in short supply, determines the federal funds rate, and thus this is the mirror of Federal Reserve policy. The Fed is very, very skilled at doing this, and they can control the rate quite precisely. They can't control all other interest rates, however. Mostly, short-term interest rates do follow the Fed funds rate around pretty closely. But while longer-term interest rates are influenced by the Fed funds rate, they also march to their own drummer sometimes as well. Bond traders might think the Fed's moves are temporary and look beyond them, or they may be unusually optimistic or pessimistic about the future and differ in their assessment from the Fed. Over the last couple of years, even though the Fed has driven short-term rates higher, longer-term rates have been slow to follow. Alan Greenspan, in his waning days in office, famously pronounced this a conundrum. Over recent weeks, long-term rates have finally gone higher, which is important because they have far more influence over the real economy than short-term rates. Mortgages are key to long-term rates, and companies often decide whether to invest and expand by comparing the profits they expect on their new ventures with prevailing long-term interest rates. So while the Fed can influence the economy, it can do so only imperfectly and not all that directly. And let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the military. And that was an excerpt from Glenn Gould performing Beethoven's Eroica Variations, using a theme, an early instance of a theme that Beethoven later used in his Eroica Symphony, a celebration of the emergence of the bourgeois individual, back when that was a progressive revolutionary force. And now we're saturated with bourgeois individualism, and it's time to move on, but that was the early 19th century. We're now joined in the studio by three folks. We're Naji Manello, who is an associate editor at the Visual Arts Press and co-editor of Cartelis Contra Una Guerra, a book of anti-war poster art published in 2004. She also worked in the People's Guide to the Republican National Convention with the Friends of William Blake, and any friend of William Blake is a friend of mine. She currently lives in Brooklyn. Ellen Moynihan is a writer and assistant director of the Small Press Center for Independent Publishing. And Jose Vasquez is president of the New York chapter of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Let's first talk about the New Yorker's Guide to Military Recruitment in the Five Boroughs, a very attractive little pamphlet which tells you all about the military recruiting procedures and where they are in New York City and what you might expect if you face them. And welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, first of all, I think a lot of people might, on first glance, think of the military as something that's populated by people from the rural South, and you know, you don't think of New Yorkers necessarily being big targets of military recruiters, but I guess they are, aren't they?
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, the reason why we pick New York is because we live here, and it's our city, and we love it, and we saw it going on, so we responded to it. If we lived somewhere else, we lived in Iowa, the book would have been about Iowa.
And in 2004, I think about 2,000 people were recruited outside of New York. Out of New York, rather, and that's 2,000 too many, especially if they're being lied to.
Yeah, being lied to. So what can people expect to hear from a military recruiter, and then how does that compare with the actual truth?
Well, you know, they're promising ever-increasing larger budgets, signing bonuses, rather. You know, I think it's like 86,000 they say you can get for college now in the Navy, 76, I think, for the Army, and most people never get that. You know, it's if anything, off the GI Bill, you get $37,000, and you have to really work hard for that. You know, you have to be in the military for, like, 8 years. You have to be in active duty for at least 3 years. You have to be going to college full-time. 15% of people that sign up for the Montgomery GI Bill don't actually get a college degree. 65% don't get money at all. And they're going to take $12,000 out of your first year's paycheck and keep it, even if you don't end up going to school. So...
Well, and what do they tell people? They often promise being a lot more flexible than they turn out to be, don't they? They give you a lot of sweet talk at the recruiting office.
Yeah, the job training is a real benefit that they tout as well. But the thing is, you don't necessarily get job training for something that's going to end up being practical in life outside the military. I mean, you'll definitely get taught how to kill, but unless you want to get a job as a bounty hunter, 99% of the time it's not going to work out for you.
Tell us about this guide. How do you put it together? What's in it, and where can people get it?
There's a few distribution points. We're still distributing it right now. There's at St. Mark's Books, Blue Stockings.
There's a place up in Harlem, Sisters Uptown Bookstore,
and Human. Mm-hmm.
Basically, the book is just about trying to get the most information out there to people in a free way, in a compact way, so they can carry it around, they can look at it at their own leisure. It's got everything from the major things that they're going to try to sell you, what the reality of them are. There's stories from former soldiers, which I think are the most compelling for me, to be able to, like, listen to somebody's life. And, you know, they're indicative of what you go through in terms of just losing civil liberties and not knowing how to get out and just sort of feeling like you're un-American once you're in the Army or the military in general. So.
What do you tell people who say, you know, I know all that, but, you know, I don't have many other options, and this is the best of a bad lot?
That was something that we wrestled with a little bit because we didn't want to tell people what to do. I mean, we really tried to take a stand where we wanted to provide as much information as possible, but not order people to do anything or even, you know. But there are options in the guide. We say, you know, have you fully checked out the opportunities in your community? Volunteer opportunities, educational, loans for college. We really didn't want to take the stand.
Also, the guide can't cure the ills of the world that make military recruitment and military enlistment you know, a sort of an option for people. I can't personally give everybody a job, and I can't make, you know, the minimum wage rise just by creating this guide. But it's about self-determination and about looking at all the facts. And no job is worth 8 years in the military. It's just not.
And how aggressive are the military about running around going to schools and trying to recruit people? And how much of it is a walk-in business at the recruiting centers?
I'd say the majority of it comes from contacting schools off of school lists now that they've got the No Child Left Behind Act, and they can literally just like pilfer through all the school lists and contact anybody. So one of the things about the guide, the heart of the guide, it's the center spread almost, are these opt-out forms, both in English and Spanish, and students can turn those in, which forbids the school to basically release their information to recruiters. Then you've got JROTC, which is, I think, the Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps, which is in about 15% of New York City high schools currently. And I think 50% of people, or cadets as they're called, that are in JROTC end up in the military. So that's a really big recruiting outlet for them.
And that's the voice of Najee Minella, who, along with Ellen Moynihan, who's also here in the studio, were involved in the production of The New Yorker's Guide to Military Recruitment in the Five Boroughs. Attractive little booklet available around town for free and full of information, and also available on the web. What's the website?
It is www.counterrecruitmentguide.org.
Counterrecruitmentguide.org.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're also in the studio is Jose Vasquez, who is the president of the New York chapter of Iraq Veterans Against the War. You are not yourself an Iraq veteran, but you are in the military, right?
That's true, Doug. Thanks for having me. I'm a career soldier. I've been in for 14 years or just about 14 years. And, you know, after September 11th, I really had to do a lot of soul searching and think through why I was in the military.
What'd you find out?
I found out that, you know, when it came down to it, after being in the military for so many years, whether it was because I was older or because I had a college education, but I really started to question my reasons for being in the military and thinking about who benefits from war, who gets the bad end of the deal. And, you know, as I looked at history, I realized that over and over again, it's poor people, it's, you know, people of color and women and children that, especially in the modern era, are the ones that are suffering. You know, I mean, there's so many examples of wars and conflicts where the majority of the people that die are not the combatants, but actually the civilians. And, you know, I'm in the medical field now in the military. It wasn't always my job. I was also in the reconnaissance before. So I know how to, you know, shoot all sorts of weapons and do explosives and all that stuff. But, you know, I really just came to the realization that for me, it was against, you know, everything that I was that I stood for, that I believed in, to want to kill people.
And tell us about Iraq Veterans Against the War. When was it started? Who's in it? How many people?
Well, Iraq Vets Against the War started actually at a Veterans for Peace conference. So there were these individual Iraq veterans who had come back from the initial invasion. Most of them were Marines because they were the first to go in. And so in the summer of 2004, these individuals had joined Veterans for Peace because they were looking for you know, other veterans who were against the war, and there was no organization yet for Iraq veterans. They met up at a conference in Boston. There were 9 founding members. And since then, we've grown to about 250 members, and, you know, every day we get somebody new that's joining, to include people that are signing up from Iraq and Afghanistan.
In your experience in the military, what are soldiers' understandings of why they're there? Do they think about politics, or do they just think they're there for a job?
When you get a bunch of soldiers in the barracks sitting around, everybody's got their ideas of politics, and, you know, a lot of people think that the majority of the people in the military are sort of right wing, which is not the case. You know, it's really a cross section of society. And so you get, you know, people whose parents were peace activists their whole lives, and for whatever reason, they decided to join the military. So I think the most poignant example of it would be, I encourage people to see the movie Occupation Dreamland. And you'll see the discussions that go on in the barracks in Iraq, in a camp outside of Fallujah. So, you know, soldiers are talking about politics, but the military is the type of institution that really discourages soldiers from talking politics, and it's they socialize you to the point where you're afraid to talk politics in uniform, and they really don't want you reading political literature, and they they're very much repressive in that regard.
I've heard that they are very the officers are very skilled at making people feel guilty about any reservations they might have, because they say you signed a contract, you volunteered, and you have to be good to your word. Is that your experience too?
Well, yeah, not only the officers, but you get that type of peer pressure from anybody, from a private all the way up to a sergeant and an officer. So it's not only limited to the officers. Obviously, the officers have a lot more responsibility as far as maintaining the morale of the troops, so to speak. But I've heard that line. You volunteered to do this, so nobody's holding a gun to your head when you went to the recruiter, and so therefore you have to fulfill your duty. But my answer to that is because I signed a contract doesn't mean that I stop thinking, and
that's not part of the contract.
That's not part of the contract, or at least a lot of people though they are afraid to speak out. I'm still in the military actually. I'm waiting for my conscientious objector status to go through, so I come across a lot of people that are against the war, but it takes a lot for somebody to take that next step, speak out against the war, tell other people what they feel, that's why I think this organization, IVAW, is so important, because it is the whole group of us are willing to speak about our experiences as veterans. A lot of us are combat veterans, and to talk about what they actually saw in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Those of us who remember the Vietnam War days remember there was an awful lot of resistance among the conscripts. There was also the GI Coffee House movement, which coffee houses near bases that provided information and places for political organization to happen. Is there anything comparable going on now with Iraq veterans and Iraq War soldiers?
Well, we've had examples of units that refused duty. So there was the 243rd Quartermaster Unit that refused to go on a mission. According to the Pentagon's old numbers, there's about 8,000 people that have deserted since the beginning of the invasion in 2003.
8,000, that's a pretty big number. That's not getting a lot of coverage, is it?
Certainly not. But, all of those 8,000 people are underground somewhere. Maybe some of them went to Canada. But, that's the Pentagon's old numbers, is that 8,000 have deserted so far. There's a big campaign up in Canada for folks that have gone up there and are trying to seek political asylum. So that's also similar. And I would say too that what a lot of people don't understand about Vietnam is that the majority of the people who revolted against the military were actually people who enlisted and were not drafted. And that's the interesting dynamic there, is that these people enlisted expecting something from the military. People who were drafted, knew they were getting shafted from the beginning, and so they were really apathetic to the mission from the beginning. But the people who went in believing the mission and then getting to Vietnam and seeing what's actually happening were the ones who were the most outspoken critics of the war. And I would say that that's a similar parallel to now, is that everybody in the military now is for the most part volunteer. I mean, we can talk about poverty draft, but that's another issue. But so people that are going there believing the mission, after September 11th, wanting to go get the bad guys, and then going there and seeing what's actually happening to the Iraqi people, and the fact that there is no real mission to speak of.
How are you spreading the word? How are you recruiting people to Iraq veterans against the war?
Well, the majority of our time is spent, speaking out everywhere, from high schools, colleges, union halls. We go to different community groups, churches. And so a lot of it's word of mouth. A lot of veterans just walk up to us, or if they see us at a demonstration, they'll come up to us and, say, hey, I'm also an Iraq vet. People are signing up from Iraq through the website, from Iraq and Afghanistan.
And I could read it in your T-shirt, IVAW.org.
That's it.
IVAW.org.
Yeah, so, that's pretty much the way we, and we're also connected with, military families who have people that are, in Iraq or coming back. And we also do support groups for combat veterans, regardless of their political views. And so that's, another way of kind of bringing people into the fold, because, we not only do we want to end the war and bring the troops home now, but, even if they were all brought home tomorrow, there's going to be lots and lots of problems that these guys are coming home with.
I would imagine a lot of them are going to come back very damaged, even if they're not physically wounded, very psychologically damaged.
I have to tell you, I just spoke to two of my friends today, and one guy emailed me at 3:30 in the morning saying that, he's been at home for the last 3 days and not been able to get out of bed. He's been drinking, and that's because there was a death in one of his friends died recently, and it had nothing to do with the war or with combat. But it just brought up all of those old feelings again for him. And so, he started remembering all of the friends, and he was a medic. So, what he told me was he started seeing all of those images again, kind of flashing before his eyes, just, from this one incident that happened from outside. And another person that I spoke to recently, he just broke up with his girlfriend, so he's very depressed. And, so it's just, there's so much, hidden trauma from this war, and it's not, the Pentagon doesn't really account these people as being wounded, but they're very much so wounded psychologically, and that's going to be something that we'll have to deal with for, as long as we have since Vietnam. I mean, there's folks that are still, now that the war in Iraq is going on, there's actually a lot of Vietnam vets who are kind of rehashing all of these feelings again, so it's not something that ever goes away.
All right, well, good luck, and thanks for joining us. Good luck with the work. Iraq Veterans Against the War, IVAW.org. And Najee or Ellen, remind people where they can get a copy of this excellent New Yorker's Guide to Military Recruitment in the Five Boroughs.
Thank you. It's at www.counterrecruitmentguide.org.
And physical copies of the booklet are available?
All over town. Bookstores, theaters, churches. Keep your eye out.
Can I just make one more announcement?
Please do.
There's an event that's coming up on Friday, April 28th at the Community Church, which is on 35th Street between Madison and Park. And it's an Iraq Veteran Speak Out. So it's going to be a lot of our members will be here from around the Northeast for the big demonstration on the 29th. That's going to be from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Community Church. And we'll have that up on our website as well.
Okay, and I'll announce that again next week just to remind people. Thanks to all of you for joining us. I've been speaking with Najee Minello and Ellen Moynihan, who are involved in producing the Counter-Recruitment Guide, and to Jose Vasquez, who is the president of the New York chapter of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Thanks to all of you for doing this important work, and good luck with it.
Thank you
very much.
Let's take a break, and we'll be back with Kevin Phillips.
Hi, I'm Scott Elliott. I'm the director of Three Penny Opera. Come check it out and keep listening to WBAI New York.
Instead of staying home in bed at night behaving, they want love. They want love. Chasing up the alley with the sentimental craving.
I love WBAI.
A bit more of Glenn Gould playing Beethoven's Eroica Variations, the theme which Beethoven later used in his Eroica Symphony, but that was an early incarnation of it. I should say, this is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, and on the web at WBAI.org. And now, an interview I recorded yesterday with Kevin Phillips, who is the author of the book American Theocracy. He's also a former Republican consultant who about 40 years ago helped Richard Nixon devise his Southern strategy, which was to turn the South Republican. I think we're living with some of the fruits of that today. But Kevin Phillips is not happy with the way things turned out. So let's listen to what he has to say.
Your subtitle kind of says encapsulates the argument in your book quite well, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. So let's just talk about a little bit about each of those in turn. Let's start with oil, which is a very obvious part of the Bush administration. How does the oil influence on Bush and his brand of the Republican Party contrast with the role of oil, which has always been very strong in the past in American politics?
Well, I think it's just accelerated. What we've seen in the last, say, 30 years is that simultaneously with oil having grown to play a much greater role in U.S. and world diplomacy and in the Middle East, we've had the Republicans emerge as the party that, once the Mason-Dixon line was wiped away, basically became the party of energy resources, coal, oil, gas. It was all pretty much in one package. So as this international situation heated up with oil having its importance globally and to us as a producing nation, you had in essence the production side of energy coming together under one party, whereas it had previously been divided. That tended to raise the importance of oil in the Republican Party. So did the emergence of the South in the Republican orbit. I wrote a book a long time ago called The Emerging Republican Majority, which basically suggested that the South would turn Republican and play an important role in that coalition. I think in the end, because of the importance of oil, that particular side of the coalition, the coming together of the energy producers in the Republican Party, was quite significant, because by the 1980s and 90s, as we had the coming of age of oil in terms of getting presidential nominations for people from that industry, we had people from Texas, basically, and we had two Republican presidents. And the second one, it was a Republican president with his vice president also coming out of the oil industry. So the rise of salience of oil in American politics has really climbed.
And so has the price of oil. It's just a little over $70, I think, as we're speaking. Also, at the same time, I think it's getting increasingly difficult for anybody but a true believer to deny the risks of climate change. So is the Republican Party, and more broadly the American political system, able to face the possibility that the end of the free burning of oil is going to be upon us, whether it's running low or not? It just doesn't seem like we can continue in the present fashion forever.
Well, I think if it's not running low, people would want to try to continue. Because it is, I think we have evidence that supports the need for major change, but the administration doesn't want to deal with that, either in terms of the peak oil theory, which would go against the book of Genesis, or some of the aspects of climate, which, in a sense, do somewhat the same thing. So I think the Republican coalition is uniquely unwilling to confront all of this, partly for religious reasons, partially for energy reasons, partially for geostrategic reasons. Clearly, they're more unable to deal with this, I think, than the Democrats would be. The Democrats need the Republicans to have to bite the bullet first, but if the Republicans do have to bite the bullet first and take the hit with all the people who drive the pickup trucks in Wyoming and who drive long commutes in from someplace in southern Ohio on the interstate, then the Democrats can probably deal with it because they don't have the producers. But either side that has to deal with it is going to hurt with the voters, and the Republicans have the least reason to try.
You mentioned peak oil being incompatible with the book of Genesis. Religion has been an important part in American politics and society from the beginning. Again, is there something more intense, more salient about it than in the past now?
I think it's fair to say that you never had problems with the book of Genesis and true believers wanting to get in the way of the oil industry before. And I think the only reason they do now is not that they're specifically, in fact, they're probably even allies of the oil industry, but they don't want to talk about what's happening. The whole question of resources is something that conflicts with their view of a relatively, although there are factions, young earth and old earth factions in the Christian right. But it conflicts with their sense of the Bible at this point in a way it never did before. And there's also the very real question of the Bible and the unfolding of the end times debate, which centers on the Middle East, and a lot of people who are actually very much in the part of the country that also has the oil industry has people who are very preoccupied with what's going on in the Middle East, and they don't want to talk about the oil aspect of the Middle East particularly, because in some of the very hardline religious books, oil is the plaything of the Antichrist, not of the good guys.
You plainly think that the U.S., if it's not about to hit the rocks, is facing some pretty rough sailing ahead. We've got debt. We haven't talked about that yet, but you write a lot about risks of domestic and foreign indebtedness. Of course, the energy problems here has just been talking about decaying economic infrastructure. People have been worrying out loud about this sort of thing since the 1980s, and it hasn't arrived yet. How do we manage to live such a charmed existence?
Well, I think they've been worrying, and portions of it have arrived, and portions of it have caused problems, but the problems haven't added up to nearly as much as they do now. Now, let me go back to the beginning of that. In the 1980s, it was clear that the United States had problems with Iraq and Iran after the Iranian hostages situation. In the late 70s and early 80s, there was concern about the oil supply coming from the Middle East. In the late 70s, they bit the bullet and introduced some real conservation measures, so the consumption of oil declined. But as you say, the United States escaped the bullet at that point because the price of oil dropped very significantly in the mid-1980s and did not get back to crisis levels really until just the last 6 or 8 years. And because of that, that commodity didn't figure nearly as much in the negative scenario. For the same reason, debt, after becoming important in the early 1980s and into the mid-1980s, was slipping back a little bit in the 1990s and was partially supplanted by the stock market bubble, making everybody very happy and thinking that tech had overcome all the national problems. That wore off in 2000, and we've developed, since the tech bubble crashed and since 9/11 came along, I think a greater fascination with what can go wrong. A lot of people do have a lot of concerns about whether the country's on the wrong track, but they're not quite ready for the convergence that I think is underway, and it's been very difficult for the media to talk about how you can simultaneously have problems of oil, of climate, of debt, global indebtedness, of people who are religious thinking that the end times are coming. Just all of this at one point in a very hot point in time, and I think it's very unusual.
Did you ever think when you were writing the emerging Republican majority 40 years ago that the middle-class populism that you're strategizing about would ever end up as the near-naked kind of plutocracy that it has emerged as?
Well, I wouldn't think Bush
addressing his constituency as the haves and have-mores?
I wouldn't say it's emerged as a near-naked plutocracy for the simple reason that one of the major side benefits of 9/11 has been the focus of a large portion of the American electorate on things that are non-economic. This was starting to happen in the 80s and 90s, but then Clinton revved up the morality issue big time, and the Republicans revved it up for him. But then since 9/11, you've had just a lot more willingness on the part of people to push economics aside. It would seem to me that at this point, the plutocracy is not what's going to get George W. Bush in trouble. It's the incompetence of his people, some of the grasping that goes too far, and the lack of preparedness for virtually anything as they just drift along, playing golf when Hurricane Katrina is coming in, ignoring the reality of the Middle East and pretending that the war is still going well. These people live in a dream world.
Bush's approval ratings are in the basement now. He's more hated than Clinton ever was, if you use the strongly disapproved share as your metric. Is this a Bush personal problem, or does it really signal serious trouble for the Republicans? Is he some sort of terminal crisis for the party, or at least in this incarnation, or can someone like McCain rescue them?
I don't think McCain can rescue them, but I'm not sure it's uniquely Bush. The Bush people have put such an imprint on the Republican Party in the last 25 years. You have to go back. If you go back to 1980, there's been only one presidential election, and that was 1996, when there wasn't a Bush on the Republican ballot for president or vice president. So they Bushified the party, and a lot of the problems in the Middle East that are being put in technicolor by number 43 were basically put on the map by number 41. I think by the time the dust finally settles, it's going to be the first war in American history to be blundered by two generations of the same party and the same family, with a sequential further weakening of our position. I think it's very hard to overstate the extent to which they've been bad news, but the Republican Party has come together with them so much, and especially from 2001 to 2003 when things seemed to be going very well, that I think the party is irretrievably tainted by it.
I'm speaking with Kevin Phillips, a former Republican strategist who is the author most recently of American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century, just published by Viking.
Write and talk a lot about the role of conservative Christians in American politics and society, but the share of seculars in the population has nearly doubled over the last decade. Younger people are a lot more tolerant of homosexuality and other kinds of nonconformity. Is the religious right really a dwindling force in the longer term, or can it keep renewing itself?
It's been a growing force, I would say, for clearly 30 years, maybe 40 years, and it's been presumed to be weakening at certain points, and then it resurges again. I would say it was helped very much by 9/11. On the other hand, in George W. Bush, it has somebody who has more than a touch of the messianic in him. I think he's God's viceroy on earth. And I think that is something, if the liberals were sharper, they could really make some hay with, because it's very presumptuous once you get down to the real nitty-gritty religion of a lot of his constituency, for him to be running around basically saying he speaks for God. Yet that doesn't get made much of an issue out of it, neither does the whole way in which he's evolved in response to 9/11. He's retracted some of that religious verbiage, but there's still a lot there. So I would say that there's a potential to embarrass the fundamentalist evangelicals and Pentecostals, and that could top out their demographics. But so far, it hasn't convincingly happened. You can see signs that the non-evangelical Protestants are shifting against some of this stuff, but I haven't seen major breakdowns on the Republican coalitional side yet.
What do you make of an argument like Rita Scherer's, that there's an emerging Democratic majority, maybe a suburban base that is socially liberal, worries about education to the environment, and could potentially be the driving force of a political realignment?
Any realignment we get isn't going to be a long-standing one. I think that the realignments of a generation are gone. If the Democrats hadn't had a president who had a incurable itch for White House interns, I think they would have had three or four administrations sequentially beginning in 1992. But if is one of the biggest words in the English language and played into the Republicans' hands and punched their ticket. If the Democrats get back in, my view, anything from here on in is going to be short term. Now, do the Democrats have a chance for a demographic there? Yes, but they've had a chance for a demographic for at least a decade and a half at this point.
Why are they so pathetic? Why are they seems like this time would be rich with the possibility for them to challenge the Republican dominance. You've got a president in trouble, Congress with a terrible image, yet they just can't seem to get off the mat. What's up?
I think the Democrats in many ways are paralyzed by the same money interest that operates in the Republican Party. The United States has turned into such a money culture that the moving of money, financial services, has actually moved ahead of manufacturing in the GDP. As what we are as a culture, I don't think it's going to be turned off. It's hard for me to see the Democrats recasting themselves somehow away from this. And what you get in the Democratic Party is that whole crowd around Bill Clinton and, to a lesser extent, the people like Bob Rubin and so forth, and a whole bunch of lobbyists who basically are like the Nelson Rockefeller people used to be to the rest of the Republican Party. They want to do the same thing as the party structure of the other party, but they just want to pretend they're different. They have a slightly different set of viewpoints. And I don't think that that's really going to work.
What do you make of Tom Frank's thesis in What's the Matter with Kansas, that the Republicans have been very successful at pulling a confidence trick, using the cultural issues to get middle and lower income whites to vote against their economic interests? People think they're voting against gay marriage, instead they get tax cuts for millionaires. Would, if the Democrats then adopt some kind of full-throated populist message? Would they be able to break out of that?
Well, first of all, they won't adopt it. But secondly, if they did, I doubt that they'd do it in a way that would work, because they'd be so purely economic in their populism, not wanting to be culturally populist in any way, that they'd overload the circuits. To me, the whole idea of what's the matter with Kansas, which is okay because it comes from a saying back in the 1890s, but it certainly would be a bad state to pick if you really wanted to make a point, because on the list of states that would be Republican most of the time, Kansas would be close to the top outside the South. It's got a lot of things coming together there that would make it Republican. And the notion that the Republicans are so clever that they've hornswoggled the people of Kansas for this agenda, I think the typical person in Kansas is aware of some of the things they don't like about the Republicans, but the minute they think of the Democrats, they think of, you know, Harvard, Manhattan, and Hollywood.
Well, that's an old theme in American politics, isn't it, the resentment of the intellectual elite? That's not something that Karl Rove invented.
No, and it's very logical, and I view as someone who was for a long time involved in the Republican Party, is it's very logical for people in Kansas to have a split set of devils, and the devils that are far away from them in Hollywood and Harvard and Manhattan are devils they don't know all that well, so they get this image of them, and whereas the devils they do know, the people who might have too big a wheat combine or be in the oil business or be a preacher or something, it's much more part of the local culture. It doesn't grab them the same way. And I think the question the Democrats would be better off asking themselves is, what's the matter with Georgetown? What's the matter with Malibu? You know, what's the matter with all of these people that can't relate enough to the middle of America to figure out why Kansas votes like it does?
How would you describe your political philosophy these days, and are there any political figures on the current scene that you admire?
Well, I'll start with the first one. We moved out of Washington almost 8 years ago because I was sick of those people. The whole idea of waking up in the morning and thinking about Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich was enough to make me reach for something or other. So I don't spend a lot of time following them. There may be people who have a lot to offer that I know nothing about. Having said that, on the Republican side, the only one that I had any interest in was John McCain. He's not saying anything much this year. Seems to be admiring Bush and courting Falwell, so that sort of takes him off the list. I don't really see anybody, but that may reflect among my lack of knowledge of people in their 40s or 30s, the fact that I'm disinterested in Washington.
And Democrats thoroughly hopeless?
I don't see any Democrat that I would like particularly. I think Hillary Clinton is a very bright woman, and I sort of like her personally, but she comes from a family that I have no use for. And the whole idea of another dynasty on the Democratic side. On one hand, we have the Bushes. On the other hand, we have the Clintons. And it's the American version of Lancaster versus York, and who needs it?
I noticed from your bio on the jacket, the dust jacket, that you're living in Litchfield, Connecticut, mm-hmm. which is a rather a posh enclave in northwestern Connecticut. And Connecticut is a state very much like New Jersey, affluent, votes consistently Democratic or substantially Democratic. Could people ask what's the matter with Connecticut?
I think it would be pretty easy to answer. Again, it's more cultural. I think what's been moving people here is not their income bracket, but their sense of distaste for what the Republicans have become. There are towns here that, I used to in the summers when we came up from New York live in a little town called Cornwall, Connecticut. Very Yankee, big Civil War monument and all of that, and was about 10-1 Republican by registration. It's changed quite a bit, and it's become very much liberal communications elite, research, writing, so forth, township, and it's now probably the most Democratic township in Litchfield County. So while all these things have changed, there is a different coloration to Connecticut. It's not so much the stereotype Fairfield County of Westport and Darien that it was 50 years ago.
And you've written about this in the past, the old Yankee cowboy conflict, the old Northeastern elite, which used to dominate the Republican Party, kind of waspish, and then giving way to the Sun Belt new class. I'm kind of interested in who is exactly is the American elite these days? You know, who might we call the American ruling class, if there is such a thing? Has anything coherent replaced that old Yankee elite, or is this country just really without a coherent force at the top of the society?
I'm closer to agreeing with that last part. I think there is a liberal elite that you can see if you go to meetings of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Harvard Faculty Club and such like. But it's not a big elite, and it's not as powerful as it once was. And if you look at the elites of the Democratic and Republican parties, they don't really overlap with that too much anymore. Those people are uncomfortable with either one. Then you've got the new religious elites. You've got the technical elites. I'm sure there are important Hispanic elites. I think that the idea of the old ruling classes based on the Northeast, or in the case of the Democratic South, based on that legacy below the Mason-Dixon line, doesn't work too well anymore. But I don't think anything really important has replaced it.
Well, and finally, from what you just say and from what you've been saying all along, it sounds like the United States is a society that is facing some very, very serious challenges over the coming years. You allude to the decline of the British Empire in the book. Are Americans actually prepared for what may be facing them in the near future?
I doubt it. I think it's very unlikely that the people in Britain, who were close to the top at least, had any good sense in 1914 of what was coming. And that's especially true when you think about how badly off they were, say, by 1947 or 48, when the British pound was crashing and they had a current account deficit that's more or less the same level of GDP that ours is now. The two world wars did it to them, but so did some of their own internal decline, and very few people really expected it in 1914, although the so-called chattering classes were starting to chatter about it, and they had been since the 1890s. I still don't think there's a willingness to acknowledge here all the things that are pointing in that direction.
And that's the voice of Kevin Phillips, former Republican strategist turned prolific author. His most recent book, American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century, just published by Viking, a quite extensive treatment of all those topics, so with a historical scholarly breadth. So if you really want to get a pretty good look at the state of American politics now and where it came from, this would be a good way to do it, even if you might not agree with Kevin Phillips' political philosophy, which is actually kind of a hard thing to get a handle on. But in any case, it's well worth reading. Intelligent, well-written, and always makes you think. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and then on into the evening. I will be back next week, and let's go out with a bit more of Glenn Gould playing the Beethoven Eroica Variations. Until next week, bye.